Assalamu alaikum. This episode is a re-airing of last year's Ramadan and Eid special. It features Dr. Lamia Behrainwala, Dr. Melinda Gonzalez, who, by the way, graduated since the original was recorded, so congratulations to her, Dr. Nosheen Pasha, Rose Dighton, Dr. Sana Rizvi, and Dr. Zainab Kaaba. I hope you enjoy it. Assalamu alaikum. You're listening to She Speaks, Academic Muslimas. This is a podcast that features Muslim women in academia, and we discuss anything and everything. My purpose here is to give a platform to our collective and individual voices. This episode is a special episode. It's the last episode of Season 2. Season 1 started in Rabiul Awwal, and Season 2 ends in the month of Ramadan and Shawwal. This episode is the Ramadan and Eid special, and it features several academic Muslimas. If you haven't already, please subscribe to the podcast and share it amongst like-minded people. We need all the support we can get. Look forward to our third season in August 2020, inshallah. And now, enjoy this episode. Assalamu alaikum, Sana. How are you?
Assalamu alaikum. Actually, wa alaikum assalam. How are you?
I'm doing okay. Thank you for being my trusted go-to person whenever I need a conversational aspect in this podcast.
What are sisters for?
I feel like I literally strong arm you into doing these things, but I do appreciate it. I swear I do.
Thank you. I enjoy it too.
You didn't have to say that. Okay. How's everything going for you? How's the son? How's the husband?
Well, I think we have adjusted to the lockdown. We are in a privileged position, mashallah, say that we can work from home. And my son, well, he's learned to mother himself, as all kids in day and age have learned to do that. I don't know which part of the house he resides in now, but I think he learned to live on his own now.
I know what you mean about which part of the house, man. My kids built a fort and then they disappeared in it for 3 days. But the funny thing is, I didn't care.
Yeah, that's the
fun. I was like, I don't know what you're doing in there, but as long as you're in there, thank you.
Yeah, I think he only comes out when it's iftar time. So, and then he goes back in. So how's been Ramadan for you?
It's been pretty good. Alhamdulillah, it's been really, really good. I like the fact that I can wake up later. I try to schedule any meetings I have later in the day, 10 onwards or 11 onwards, so I can sleep in. Because, if you wake up in the middle of the night, you have a hard time going back to sleep. At least I have a hard time going back. So then I'm sleeping at 6 a.m. I like it that I'm able to sleep until 10 a.m. after. So I'm enjoying this sort of Ramadan. And then the other aspect of Ramadan that I've been thinking about a little bit more this Ramadan is that the idea of being unproductive, and I have the privilege of being unproductive, doing the bare minimum possible in work. And I always do that every year in Ramadan. But I think this year I've sort of realized that I've started to embrace this idea, because I used to feel really sucky about being unproductive, but I've sort of embraced the idea, not just it's okay, but I should be unproductive during Ramadan. But I know that's only because I'm in a super duper privileged position of the kind of job that I have. And what about you? How's your Ramadan?
This was a weird year because it made me realize how Ramadan only exists for university students, but does not exist for staff and faculty, because all the extensions and the accommodations that we always make are because we have to be kind. We are always told to be kind to our students during Ramadan. And that's a good idea, but there's never a conversation on how it impacts faculty who are fasting themselves. And because
are you talking about all those, now people have all those posters that I see floating on Facebook saying, remember, this is a month of Ramadan, be kind to your students who might be fasting, don't schedule exams first thing in the morning and stuff like that. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, I think, I mean, more and more, and that's a good conversation that we're finally beginning to see it as a normal thing, you know, that it's okay that students can have reasonable accommodations, that we have to be mindful of people's commitments, religious commitments. And that's a good conversation. But I think that conversation just ends there. And very rarely do we just say, okay, have you thought about how it impacts staff? And I think this is a more serious issue during lockdown, because as you know, I teach online. So actually, my teaching never stops. And I'm also teaching during summers. Any kind of, you know, that Ramzan feel that I used to have before, it's literally gone out of the window, because I am constantly teaching online or marking papers or whatever, because nothing has stopped, you know, when you teach online. And so it made me kind of reflect on how selective care is demonstrated at a time like this, and that it still has to be performed in such a way that it's compatible with the new liberal functioning of a university. So as long as it's satisfying consumers, which are the students in this case, it's fine. We don't have to worry about adjuncts, part-time hourlies. We don't have to worry about Muslim staff who are fasting right now and how they're teaching and coping with their life right now under lockdown. That is the other side of it. But other than that, I think I have to say that I'm also really happy that my son is fasting, and that at least he has these values that I'm proud of, and that he's able to do this under lockdown. But
so it's almost, is it like, yeah, this outward performance of care, like this outward facing performance of care for the world to see, without actually caring for?
I think, I mean, it would be interesting, wouldn't it be, if I did say, I mean, I oftentimes wonder if I did apply and say, look, I'm fasting and I need some sort of leniency in this, or some sort of accommodation. Now, how I envision this to be, you know, to go on is they would say, okay, there's a procedure. You need to apply as sick leave or extenuating circumstance. So there would be a proper bureaucratic process to it. I don't think it's something that is naturally built into the system. It's something that you have to think twice. Okay, I'm really going to apply through a laborious process of applications to prove that I need some sort of accommodation. And I don't think many people would actually consider doing that.
Yeah, especially because it might ruffle the wrong feathers. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I you know, I really appreciate you sharing that. And I bet that is the experience of many, many people who have the kind of workload that you do. So I do appreciate that.
Yeah. Oh, I'm glad I shared it.
So now I'm speaking to Nosheen Pasha, a professor at Houston Community College. Asalaamu Alaikum, Nosheen.
Wa Alaikum Salaam. How are you?
Alhamdulillah. How are you?
Alhamdulillah. I'm doing good.
Ramzan Mubarak.
Yeah, Ramadan Kareem to you too.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I noticed you said Ramadan Kareem. What's up with that?
You know, that's a really great question. And Ramzan and Ramadan, they're the same thing, but they have different connotations for me. I am from Pakistan. And so I know that there's a lot of talk about the Arabization of words like Sehri and Ramzan and things like that, and going to Ramadan and going to Sahur. And for me, the difference really comes from the experiences I had. When I was growing up, I grew up in the United States, and Ramzan was, to be really honest with you, a very stressful time for me every year. You know, God forgive me, but I had a lot of issues with my health. And so, but nothing that was like diagnosable. I had a lot of migraines and, you know, maybe things associated, you know, with my stomach problems. I don't know. No one ever was able to diagnose them. And so I never felt like I, you know, was deserving of any kind of way to get around fasting. And so every year I would try to fast and I would get horrible, horrible migraines. And I would end up throwing up somewhere around, you know, Zohar time or something. So I hardly ever made it to the end. And it was just every year, I was just scared to death of Ramadan coming up.
You know, can I tell you something? I can actually relate to that, because I had similar issues for a bunch of years. And then I don't know, in my particular case, it went away by itself. But I would dread the coming of Ramadan, because the first couple of days, I would just have massive migraines and I wouldn't know why or what to do. And then they would I didn't have the case that would happen every day. In my case, it was just, but I completely understand, like, this idea of like dreading the first day, because you know you're going to be crashing with like a massive exploding head.
Yeah, and for me it was just like, you know, just the idea of it was giving me anxiety even a few weeks before Ramadan would start. And that feels horrible for me now, because alhamdulillah, you know, after the last maybe like, I don't know, 10 years or so, I've been really able to get the spirit of Ramadan. And that's why I say Ramadan now, because for me, I went to live overseas in the United Arab Emirates. I was in Dubai for somewhere around 7 years. And that's when I really was able, my health, maybe something happened with my health. Maybe it was the fact that everybody was fasting. You couldn't eat outside, you know, during the day. It was just
right.
A totally different kind of an experience for me. And alhamdulillah, I was able to fast since then. And I didn't have the same kind of biological response to it. And so for me, I just always say Ramadan Kareem, even though I know that a lot of people say, oh, you know, you're Pakistani, you should say Ramadan Mubarak. But for me, Mubarak has a totally different connotation than Ramadan Kareem. And I love Ramadan. It's one of my favorite times of the year now, alhamdulillah.
I really appreciate that memory of and that journey that you just told about, you know, from Ramadan Mubarak to Ramadan Kareem. MashaAllah, that's amazing.
Thank you so much. Thank you for allowing me to share this my journey.
Assalamu alaikum, Nausheen.
Alaikum salam. Have a good Eid, inshallah.
You too. So right now I'm talking to Melinda Gonzalez, who is a PhD candidate in the field of anthropology at Louisiana State University. Assalamu alaikum, Melinda.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Ramadan Mubarak.
Ramadan Kareem.
Yeah, we were just discussing the discrepancy between the Mubarak and the Kareem. Yes, but how's everything going? How's this Ramadan been treating you?
Alhamdulillah, it's funny because I use Kareem and Mubarak like interchangeably, right? So if somebody says Ramadan Kareem to me, I respond Mubarak, and if they say Mubarak, I respond Kareem. But alhamdulillah, it's been good. It's the first Ramadan I've fasted in a couple years due to some health issues that I was having. And alhamdulillah, like, it's been so much easier than I thought it would be to not eat for 16 hours, right?
Yeah.
I think it helped that I was doing intermittent fasting before Ramadan. But
oh, perfect.
Yeah, but like, you know, the issue is like you can't even have water, right?
Right.
I saw this Instagram post yesterday that it was like not even water, and it was like white proverb during Ramadan. Right. But yeah, I think like other than the thirst that happens sometimes, alhamdulillah, like I wasn't really hungry, or like, you know, I would pass, you know, after a while, like I would just start I would like read Quran or like watch a video, and then the desire for food just kind of dissipated, right? And then I think too, like, also not eating, like you focus on other things, and then just like being more mindful of praying, right? And this Ramadan, I did a few things. Like I was attending the iftar and suhoor by the IC, so the Islamic Center at New York University. That's usually where I pray Juma. So they had a lot of online programs. So I was doing a lot of that. And I met a lot of beautiful people, alhamdulillah. So just spent a lot of time on Zoom.
That's good to keep that sense of community, yeah.
Yeah, alhamdulillah. I also took a class, a Ramadan intensive, with this woman, Angelica Lindsay Ali, I think it's her last name. And they call her the village auntie. She's all over social media. She's really great. So I took a Ramadan class with her that was just for women. And so doing that, I started Ramadan with like intentions of like, you know, like what do I want to accomplish this Ramadan? And I had a really, really long list. And then life humbles you and it's like, okay. So I was like, I'm going to memorize all of Ayat al-Kursi, but I have one line, alhamdulillah, that's more than I had before. And then just also like becoming aware, like, so one of the things I had on my list was like becoming more self-aware, mm-hmm. and also becoming more conscious while I'm praying, and just like about my interactions with people and discovering throughout Ramadan in the first few days. Because, you know, like, you're not just fasting from food and water. You, like, can't have intercourse. You're not supposed to, like, you know, you have to watch how you speak. Like, you know, you have to, like, try not to get angry and, like, all this other stuff, right? It's about protecting yourself. Yeah.
Yeah, the idea that it's not just about food and thirst, it's about a lot more about your whole spirituality. So did you have any gain on that front as well?
Yeah, so what I discovered a few days into Ramadan is that I have a short temper. And
I think we all discovered that in Ramadan, yeah.
I get mad really fast. Like, I don't, like, blow up really fast, but I get really annoyed really fast. And I didn't notice that before, how quickly I get mad. Mm-hmm. So, alhamdulillah, I've been, like, working on it and, like, praying to Allah for more patience and more calm. And it's funny because last night I was talking to my husband about it. And I was like, I feel like Ramadan has changed me. And he was like, yes, it has. And I was like... I was like, I'm offended. What do you mean? Yeah, I was like, I feel like a better, calmer person. He's like, right?
Like, hey, you're supposed to say, no, I'm perfect. No.
Right? He's like, sure did. So alhamdulillah, like, I do feel like I'm more concentrated in my salah. Like, I'm working on it. You know, sometimes your brain wanders when you're making salah and, like, so I feel more concentrated. I feel like I'm more conscious of the words coming out of my mouth. Yeah. You know, like, sometimes I can unfortunately curse like a sailor, you know, but during Ramadan, like, you have to, you know, really watch what you say. And, like, now when other people curse, like, you know, they say, like, profanity, I become really hyper-conscious of other people. And I'm like, bro, I'm fasting. Can you watch how you speak, right? Like, so... Yeah, it's just been, like, it's been that, like, just becoming really conscious of my emotions and the words that I'm speaking. Yeah.
Oh, man, that's what we aspire to gain through Ramadan, and it looks like that's your experience. That's amazing that you had that experience because, you know, a lot of us don't, even when we aspire to it, we still end up screaming our kids out. And I sometimes catch myself and I'm like, my kids are fasting too, Saba, stop. You know, being so upset, like, not only are you ruining your fast, you're also ruining your kids' fast.
Yeah, because especially in quarantine, like, just being stuck indoors with your child all the time. Yes. You love them, but, like, it gets annoying after a while. Yes. It's like, is school starting yet?
Yeah.
No, but alhamdulillah, like, I think, too, it's becoming just conscious, right? Becoming, you know, having more taqwa, right? Like, of becoming conscious of Allah, but also, like, just becoming conscious of yourself, right? Like, another thing too that I worked a lot this Ramadan is, like, becoming conscious of what I'm eating, right? Because, like, when you can only eat twice, right, you start thinking about caloric density and, like, nutrient density and everything that you eat, right? It's like,
that is so true.
Yeah.
You're like, I shouldn't be eating this because this is a lot of processed sugar, but it gives me zero nutrients to keep me through the next day. And it might make me constipated because I'm not getting enough fruits and fibers into my diet. Like, all those thoughts cross your head. And on a regular day-to-day basis, they don't as much. Well, thank you so much, Melinda, for that. Thank you for sharing. That was amazing.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for having me on.
Okay. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam.
Okay, so I'm back on with Sana now. So Sana, I wanted to talk about something that's actually kind of taboo, which is periods and fasting.
Ooh.
Have you seen that video of I don't know who makes it. I should really look that up.
I think it's a South Asian one. What, there's one which is South Asian and there's one which is Arab. I know. So there are two videos circulating, but they're both hilarious because they literally capture the dynamics between men and women in a household where the woman is not fasting and the question comes, why aren't you fasting?
Right. So I'm gonna put the link to the videos in the notes of the show. But yes, I mean, it's super awkward, especially if you live in a joint family system. I think if you live in a nuclear sort of a household, like sort of a heteronormative, like, you know, just husband and wife and the child, it's a little bit more, I suppose, less awkward or not awkward at all. Yeah. But when you live in a joint family system with your father-in-law and your brother-in-law, lots of other figures that you don't want them to know,
even your father. I mean, I remember growing up, I don't know whether you remember, but our dad used to be like, okay, so are you fasting? Have you done namaz? And we'd be like, oh.
So the funny thing is we live with the same father right now, and you know, right now I'm actually on my period days, and yesterday we had to make like lots of iftar for distribution, and Abu made this fruit chart, and then I think he was kind of shocked because I just took a spoon and I taste tested the fruit chart he made.
Oh, the horror of horrors.
I think it took him a second to realize I wasn't fasting. And then I said, Abu, this is too much salt in it, too much. And he's like, okay, I'll fix it. And then, you know, he went about to fix it. But it took like a split second for him to realize, oh, she's not fasting. I think, a couple of days back, I think when my period started, I didn't wake up for Sehri, which my husband really wanted me to wake up for Sehri. Yeah. And I told him, why would I mess up my sleep schedule just to wake up for, like, what do you, he's like, we'll hang out.
It's like 3 in the morning. Weird impression management. So did you wake up? So,
no, man, it's 3 in the morning.
Oh, that is funny. Oh, but we do engage in impression management. I have to say this because on the days that I had my period, and this was like about a few, you know, a week back, my son, he was fasting, and he said, are you, because I was studying on the dining table. My office is my dining table at the moment. And he could see I'm, you know, every time he used to come into the dining table, I just put the mug, you know, the coffee mug under the table. And then finally he asked me, are you fasting? And I just, and although I've explained to him periods a gazillion time, but I think with boys at his age, he constantly forgets. So he's like, I just said, you know, I have a headache. And then that was it. And then he just walked out. But now it's like, he doesn't even question. So there is an impression management that all women, I think, perform with, whether with their son or their father or their husband or whatever. I think with her husband, it's less so. Yeah.
I think more than impression management, I think for my kids, like right now I'm in the car recording this because I came out for lunch because I don't want to eat in the house. So I know both my kids know that I'm not fasting for these small number of days, but I don't also want to eat in front of them for just good akhlaq reasons.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's a little bit of that too, that, you know, your small kids are fasting and, you know, your son's 10 and my son's 10. And I just don't want them to, you know. I think a couple of days ago, which was my first day of not fasting and I didn't wake up for Sehri, my son was like, you're not fasting, Mama? I said, no. And I said, do you know why? And then he's like, does this have anything to do with menses? I was like, yes. I said, do you have any questions about it? He's like, no. And then he was just like wanting to escape the room. And I was like, well, do you know how often it comes? And he's like, once every hour. I was like, no, I meant like how often it comes in a year. Like, does it come every year, every month? He was like, oh, I think every 3 months. And I was like, oh my God, we've done this lesson with you so many times. And I was like, no, it comes once a month. Do you know for how long it comes? I mean, he'd completely forgotten everything that was taught to him. And then I was like, so do you have any other questions? He's like, nope. And then he just like, you know, got up and left. But you know that the thing that stuck out to me was that like I met like adult grown men who don't know all of this stuff. And so it made me realize, like, you know, these adult grown men taught some thoughts at age 10.
Yeah.
And then they stopped thinking about it. And their thoughts have not grown since age 10. You know, they talk just like my son.
Yeah, but I can imagine this being so because I've experienced this growing up in Pakistan. When I used to go to college there, I remember not only all the shops were closed, but because we were fasting and we were giving exams in college, and every time when we, you know, if someone like me or my friend would have periods, we would literally hide out in a car or someplace in the campus and eat, because we didn't want boys in the class to ask us. Boys, I'm saying boys, but they're actually, you know, men from age 19 and above, asking us why we're not fasting, because obviously they've not, nobody has told them about this, and it's a, you know, topic of taboo.
I mean, the other thing I said to my son was that, you know, the reason you shouldn't ask a woman is not just simply because she may not be comfortable revealing to you, but also because it's none of your beeswax why somebody's not fasting.
Oh yeah, that should be the first thing.
Yeah, I was like, remember, like Musa had some like strange medical condition. I was like, yeah. Would you want somebody to know about your medical condition? He's like, no. I was like, exactly. So people don't fast for many number of reasons, yeah. and it could be that you have like this big grading deadline coming up, so you're fasting, and then one day you don't fast, and then if somebody says, why aren't you fasting, and you say, well, I have this massive grading deadline that's tomorrow, and I have to get this done, I have to, you know, I can't stay up half the night for Sehri and stuff like that, then there's this moral judgment attached to them that is not for them to give. Why are they giving this moral judgment? That's for God to decide, like, what your circumstances are, how dire they are, how your job or livelihood might depend on it, or how your health depends on it. And so people are like, well, why are you not? Okay, let me. Oh, I see. It's you're diabetic. That's okay. That's okay. Reason for not you to fast. There's no moral judgment from
me now. Very interesting. This is very interesting, because when you say the very same people who would judge women for, you know, or ask them at least about periods and something, but for something like, you know, illness or old age or diabetes, it's so natural, the reaction. Oh, so it's almost like, you know, yeah, I wouldn't at all question or morally judge you on that. But for some odd reason, with women, it's a much harsher scrutiny about, you know, why aren't you fasting? Okay, oh. Or they're new moms, first-time moms, and you know how hard
can it be? And then other first-time mom was like, "Well, I was nursing my baby and I was able to fast while 30. Great for you, man. Awesome. I love you for it. But can we not ask other nursing moms, you know, why they are or they're not fasting? If they can, that's great. That's great for them that they could. But let's not, you know, let's not make this into a competition of, let me judge your reasons. Let me judge your reasons to be valid enough so that I can think of you as a good person in my head."
Yeah, definitely. I think, I mean, there's a tendency in all the aspects that we, you know, as a Muslim that we, you know, engage in, for instance, namaz, salat, zakat, and all of this. There's always a judgment, because we are always thinking, instead of thinking of how we are performing this for the pleasure of God, we are also thinking about, oh, we're also doing this because people are judging and watching us. And there is like this impression that we have to maintain that we are practicing Muslims. And I think that is so, you know, just, but that's how it is, I guess. Yeah.
So now I'm speaking to Rose Dighton, a graduate student in the Department of Religion at Emory. Assalamu alaikum, Rose.
Wa alaikum assalam.
How's Ramadan Mubarak? How's Ramadan going for you?
Ramadan Kareem, it's going well for me. Thank you for asking. Slow and quiet.
Slow and quiet is good, I guess. Yes, thank you for doing this. I wanted to ask if you had any memories of Ramadan that you wanted to share with us.
Yeah, I've been thinking a lot lately about my first Ramadan. And at that point, I didn't really know how to pray yet. I knew the movements of the prayer, but I had recently just converted. And so my friend, who had also recently converted and had, you know, 1 year of Ramadan in her bag, she would call me and, you know, wake me up for suhoor every morning. And it was really hard. You know, this just one simple thing to wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning, and she would call and I would, you know, let it go to voicemail, and she would call back and she would say, no, get up and, you know, eat your toast. And then she'd text me after and say, you didn't eat it all, did you? You know, things like that. And
that is so sweet. I mean, that support must have meant a lot at that time.
It did mean a lot. And it was good to have someone, you know, to go through it. And even though we were in different places, we could call each other and talk each other through hard stuff.
Since then, have you developed a lot more network of people?
Absolutely, absolutely. I feel that in the beginning, it was very much me and my books when I first became Muslim. But, you know, over the last 10 years, I've met so many wonderful people.
Oh, that's amazing. How does that correlate with this particular Ramadan, that memory?
Yeah, it definitely does. I think, you know, sometimes we have so many expectations of all of the things we're going to do in Ramadan, the social gatherings, the extra ibadah, all these things. And that just reminds me that it's okay to be simple and to do your best and to, you know, be compassionate with yourself in whatever limitations you're facing.
Right. That's a really important lesson to remember. Thank you so much, Rose, for that.
Oh, thank you.
Assalamu alaikum.
Walaikum salam.
Okay, so back on with Sana. So Sana, I wanted to talk to you about Ramadan memories or Ramadan stories, anything that, like, over the years that kind of stands out to you about your, you know, Ramadan experiences.
Oh, I'm going to take you back way, way, way back. Remember when we were like about 11 and we used to play in the gully, you know, in the lane, in our house lane. And at that time, we used to play nonstop and until there was a public siren for iftar time. You remember those times?
Yes.
As soon as everyone would hear that siren, it was like a siren that could be heard across the city. I mean, I think it was so coordinated across all mosques. But as soon as the siren went that it's iftar time, all the children, wherever they were in terms of their playing, you know, they would just run back to their house because
it was
not
like
a moment.
Instant disappearing of everybody. Yeah.
Yeah. And the street would be like literally a ghost town. It would be like that. But I think one of my really funny things that I always still remember was my time when we had this Roza Khushai, and it was my Roza Khushai. So Roza Khushai is like, you know, the first time you actually keep a child keeps a fast. The family celebrates it big style, and you know, iftari is distributed everywhere and relatives come in or whatever. So we had my Roza Khushai, the day I kept my fast. And I remember I was going to St. Michael's. I did pretty well the whole day. Like, it was a very long school day. And at 3 p.m., when I sat in my school bus, I was holding an ice cream cone. And I think it was you who reminded me in the middle of my, I don't know, chatter, conversation, whatever we were talking about, that, Sana, aren't you supposed to be fasting? And I swear to you, I don't know when I forgot I was fasting that I bought an ice cream cone. It was weird because as soon as I realized, I really don't know what I did with it. I probably would have eaten the whole ice cream because I didn't want to waste that precious, expensive ice cream and then carry on as if nothing had happened. So yeah, that was like a dose of reality. Oh yes, can't waste food in this because ice cream is expensive, but must fast for the rest of the day and pretend like it was, you know, it never happened. So yeah, I did that.
I think like every child, you know, every child has gone through some version of that where they take a bite of something and then a second later they realize, oh my God, what am I doing?
I didn't just take a bite. I think I finished. I'm pretty sure I finished. What about you?
You know, when I was a kid, this is so embarrassing. But when I was a kid, I actually thought that if you go take a poop, you break your fast.
That is
so I thought you had to hold your poop the entire time.
You know, it's inhaling, not exhaling. Oh, you took it to another level, did you?
Yeah, but you know, I'm not the only one. I recently found out that a nephew of mine also held that belief for a certain number of days of Ramadan. His mom asked him, like, he's like, Mom, I think I'm getting constipated. She's like, oh, that's normal during Ramadan. Eat some grapes and stuff. He's like, it's so hard not to poop when it's coming. And she's like, just go poop. But I don't want to break my fast.
Oh, poor soul.
So yeah, but
you
yeah,
just those tell are... me it's been a very long time. How old were you then?
I would like to say I was very young, you know, I don't know.
Believe you,
but
believe
actually
you.
Also my first Roza Khushai, I did take a bite out of her. I was climbing up amrood tree. Like, what's an amrood? I think the closest relative in the US is a guava tree.
Yeah.
And I picked up a guava from the tree as I was climbing it, and then I just took a bite off it, and then somebody who was at the bottom of the tree said, aren't you having your Roza Khushai party today?
I think then it's a rite of passage that everyone must do this.
I was like, oh my god, with a few hours to go, what did I just do? I think it is a rite of passage. The other memories, I don't know if you have this memory considering we grew up together, is that, you know, during Ramadan, we would have like these Roza Khushais and party iftar parties around the lane that we lived in.
Yeah.
And I think we and this other household were the Fawaiwala people.
I remember.
Were the only Shia households, and everybody else was Sunni household. And Shias opened their fast about, you know, 15 minutes longer.
Yeah.
After, do you remember those awkward 15 minutes?
I think, you know, the funniest thing is, I think as we grew old, so initially I remember that we would arrive deliberately at a
late
time that was closest,
yes,
to our breaking of the fast, so
yes,
that it didn't look as awkward as it would. But
yeah,
I think
everybody's like going at,
exactly,
food, and you're just standing in the corner staring.
It just
at everybody
looks pathetic.
Going at food.
It just looks like, you know, we're creeps. We do look like creeps watching people eat.
Yeah.
And but I think as I grew older, I think it became more of a, I think it's the company I kept. I had friends from different faiths, and we try, you know, they would take the piss out of it. Oh, Sana, you know, you're, let us eat as much as we can in front of you. And I would be like, you know, yeah, I'll pull your leg or whatever. And so it became something, you know, that I became more comfortable discussing, you know, our differences in breaking fast time. So it was nice. I mean, growing up, I always thought those 10 or 15 minutes were very crucial, because obviously my Sunni friends didn't want to look like they're mean and selfish, gobbling away food after a long day.
Yeah, yeah.
But
yeah,
also, we didn't want to look like weirdos looking at them eating.
Yeah, and you would feel bad because you feel like you're holding somebody else back. Well, thank you, Sana. I really enjoyed having this conversation with you, as always.
Thank you.
And I hope you get your grading done. I hope you find some time to work on your own research and also to spend some time with family. I know you're like buried under enormous amounts of work, administrative and teaching wise.
But alhamdulillah, you know, I'm very privileged. I still feel like, you know, there's at a time when a lot of people are, you know, going through,
yeah,
a lot of hardship. I feel still very, very privileged, and I still get to spend time with my son. So, I mean, it's,
mashallah,
yeah, it's a good thing,
yeah,
mashallah. So,
Alhamdulillah, same here. I do feel very, very blessed. And yeah, I mean, I hope Allah Ta'ala eases the suffering of people around the world.
Ameen.
Ameen. Well, thank you again. Inshallah, I'll speak to you soon on Eid.
Yeah, inshallah. Take care.
Eid Mubarak.
Eid Mubarak.
Future
Eid Mubarak. In advance.
Yes, Eid
Mubarak.
In advance, yes.
Okay. Allah Hafiz.
So speaking to me now is Lamia Bahrainwala, assistant professor at the Department of Communication Studies at Southwestern University. Assalamu alaikum, Lamia.
Wa alaikum salam, Sabah. It's nice to be here with you.
Thank you so much for doing this. How's your Ramadan going?
Well, Ramadan is going okay so far. And of course, it's a different Ramadan because of C19 that's going around. So it's definitely been harder to be reflective because for us, Ramadan involves a lot of community. We have iftar with our Muslim friends quite a bit. We get together for namaz. So that's been a little bit challenging. But at the same time, I have been thinking more and more this Ramadan about how my own work, which focuses on anti-Muslim sentiment, how that is more and more my way of serving the ummah and trying to protect the ummah. So that's sort of new thoughts that have come to me this Ramadan. And I was also thinking that this Ramadan, it felt like a good time to opt out and say, I'm not fasting with isolation and no childcare and the kids at home. There were good reasons not to fast. But then I thought that the point of Ramadan is to kind of push yourself. And, you know, during the Prophet's time, people pushed themselves to fast. And I know there are allowances for when we don't need to fast, you know, if you're sick or traveling and all of that. But I thought that it was an important challenge for me to take on this time. But yeah, that's my experience so far.
Oh, that's pretty amazing. And how is it managing the kids with no school?
That has been hard, but we've been sticking to a really rigid routine. And their nap time is my break in the middle of the day. So that's been keeping us afloat.
Oh, amazing. So what are you going to do to make Eid special? I mean, what makes Eid special in the U.S. is Eid prayers or Eid namaz. And we won't be able to do it this year, it looks like. So what are you going to do to get that sense of Eid in the house?
Yeah, that's such a good question. You know, in a place where you're a minority, your community becomes that much more important. That's how it is when you're marginalized in any way. So Eid becomes more challenging now when you're isolated. So I was actually just texting with some of my cousins who live in my city. And what we're going to do is their family and ours, they have little kids the same age as mine. They're going to come over. We're going to do khutbah together. And then we're going to go get some halwa puri and have an Eid breakfast at a park and let the kids play together. And then maybe go get some ice cream. And that way we're still keeping the group of people under 10. So, you know, we're still being careful and, you know, trying to observe social distancing rules, but we'll still have some semblance of Eid for our kids. It'll be the first time they've seen other children and interacted with other children in a few months, you know, and we're going to give their kids Eid.
Right. That's a pretty tough decision. Yeah. I mean, to figure out what to do in this scenario. I'm glad you figured out a way to make it work for you. Thank you so much, Lamia.
Thank you, Saba.
Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam.
So right now I'm talking to Dr. Zainab Kaba, who is the Associate Director for Programs at Skoll Center at the Said Business School at University of Oxford. Assalamu alaikum, Zainab.
Wa alaikum salam. Thanks for having me.
Oh no, thank you so much for doing this. I so appreciate it. Ramzan Mubarak.
Ramadan Kareem.
I know Eid's coming up. Eid's right around the corner from when we're recording. What are your plans for Eid this year?
Yeah, you know, this has been really an interesting Ramadan for me in many ways. So, you know, I used to work for a higher educational Muslim institution in Cambridge. And so much of the work during Ramadan leading up to Eid is really about servicing the Muslim community and providing programming for them. That's to help them with their spiritual nourishment during the month. And, you know, it's interesting because, you know, I think people often don't realize like how much and the amount of, you know, work and the people that are responsible for that and what that really means for sometimes the sacrifices that they have to make for their Ramadan. So, but this year I'm not formally kind of left that organization last year, and my involvement has been much less this year. And it's really allowed me to have a different type of Ramadan leading into a very different type of Eid this year, which with COVID is probably going to be very solitary, physically solitary. My husband and I will be at home, probably in our garden, having a picnic and taking pictures of ourselves dressed up to share with friends and still make sure we take part in, you know, sharing Eid pictures. Right. Yeah, so that's what we will be this year.
I think I'm also going to make my kids just dress up for the heck of it and take a picture of them, and then they can go back to their pajamas.
I think it's not Eid if you don't dress up, really. I mean, like, is it really? It's not. You know, it has to, you still have to do everything that you would be doing normally if you were going to the mosque and going to see friends and everything. So, yeah, I'm planning to do all of those things regardless, even if it means I'm just going a few steps to our backyard. So that's fine.
That's wonderful. Was that your experience growing up as well, like for Eid, dressing up and all that stuff?
Yeah, you know, so, you know, I grew up, my mother made our clothes. So there were, you know, six of us growing up, six siblings all together. And my mother, for a long time, you know, sewed all of our clothes. My father also owned his own clothing business. So, you know, between them, we kind of had clothes sorted and didn't really have to go much to the shops and the stores to buy things. But, you know, I think like one of my, you know, there's a picture of myself that I recall where my mom, you know, we dressed us in white, you know, my sister and I in our white khimars and dresses, to go to Prospect Park in Brooklyn. And that was, you know, the memories that I have from that, I think, are, you know, they're so vivid. You know, I can see us finishing the prayer, and, you know, they used to throw out candy to the kids, you know, mm-hmm. almost, you know, just bags of candy, chasing one another through the park and just stuffing our faces and, you know, just getting into all kind of craziness that, you know, that you get in that age. And that's one of my earliest memories of Eid at that time, you know, as a young child.
That's pretty amazing. And then growing up, was it similar, or did the magic wear off a little bit?
Yeah, that's a good question. Yeah, I think the magic does, the magic did wear off a bit, because you get pulled into, you know, working and jobs that I had where I was able to change my hours in order to accommodate fasting. And yeah, and in many ways, you know, I would a lot of times go to, you know, go to the mosque after work and for Tarawih, and then be home. And then Eid was really, you know, I think as a family, we didn't do Eid as much all together. Sometimes we would get together at someone's house, siblings, we all were living in different places. But oftentimes I would go locally. So I used to live right around the corner from Masjid Khalifa in Brooklyn and Bed-Stuy, which is also down the block from Masjid Taqwa, which is, you know, in some ways more well-known. And yeah, you know, those, you know, in Masjid Khalifa, it was very much kind of like Black Eid experience. It was like Eid was a block party almost, you know, and block off the street, and there's just food and music. And yeah, and that's how it was, you know, and
I can't imagine that happening in the Midwest, like having a block party for Eid. Like, I guess I don't live in a Muslim dense area at all. But, you know, I mean, when I lived in Kentucky, we had an Eid prayer next to a car mechanic shop, and it was like a hall, like it was like a weird, bizarre place. And I only had two Eid prayers there. But it was like, I felt sad praying there, because I was like, this is not the celebration I had in mind for my kids. But that makes me happy that in New York, the experience is just so much more different. There are just so many more people, so many more cultures, and then support from the city as well.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and I think that definitely makes a difference, kind of like, and then I would say as I got, you know, a little bit older, and then I left the States to study further, and I spent a lot of time with a friend in Cairo, so, you know, almost 2 years on and off with her, and yeah, we almost made it a point to make sure that we were always somewhere, you know, we're so always somewhere else for Eid in some ways. So, you know, the last 10 days of Ramadan, we would go to Jerusalem. I went with her 1 year, but it was her practice to go every year, went to Jerusalem, and did the last, you know, 10 days of Ramadan in Jerusalem. And then I have siblings that live in Jordan, half siblings that live in Jordan, and, you know, went to do Eid with them, crossing the border into Jordan from Israel. And and then doing Eid with them and doing Eid in Jordan, which is, you know, just family and going out to the mall and eating and, you know, going to, you know, hot springs. And, you know, it's just kind of like being with one another and just the feeling of being, you know, like free and happy and all of that, which I feel is like so much of what, you know, Eid is supposed to be.
So in these Muslim majority countries like Egypt and Jordan, Is it like the whole society isn't that celebratory? Does it feel different than, let's say, in New York, where there are lots of Muslims, but the whole society is not Muslim?
I mean, I think it depends on where you live, right? Definitely kind of in the States, you know, if you live in a community that's very densely populated with Muslims and all the shops and places that you frequent are Muslim, you will kind of get that. But when you go outside of that, you go to work and that kind of thing, you know, it's going to be different. And, you know, Muslim majority country in some ways, you know, I think a lot of people are aware of that. And it's, you know, there are Ramadan hours for working and, you know, there's allowances for many different things and everything is shut, you know, but then the city comes alive after iftar, and, you know, and you can be going to tahajjud at 2 o'clock in the morning and let there be a lot of people on the street, and you not necessarily have to be so concerned about safety and that kind of thing. So yeah, and, you know, we would do silly things like that, and, you know, spent one Eid in, you know, in Dahab, which is, you know, by the Red Sea, and climbing a mountain, and we're go and look at the stars, and the next day just spending Eid at some very small mosque that's in the town and smiling with people, and you know, another year being in some oasis in outside of Egypt, and also going to some other random mosque and just being with people. And I think that's the beauty in some ways, like you always I think that's what I've always loved about Eid. You know, and like after you do the taslim for and you finish the salah, or after the khutbah of Eid, that, you know, you turn to someone and then someone's always there to smile at you and to hug you.
Yeah.
Because of that, you know, just, you know, so anytime we're in any of those countries and, you know, being obviously foreigners and people can tell that we're foreigners, would still just turn to us and smile and, you know, give us whatever the Eid gift that they were giving to everybody in the mosque, and hug us and say, and you know, spread salam. So yeah, so I think that's kind
a beautiful
of
experience
about Eid this year, and not having that.
Yeah, that those are beautiful experiences. I mean, wow. I mean, that does sound just simply amazing. And something that, you know, sometimes I do, because sometimes in the Midwest, like on Eid, you have to teach a class. One Eid, I was dressed up and then I just went to class straight right after Eid prayers, like literally rushed because I didn't want to cancel class. But then I spent the first 5 to 10 minutes explaining to my students what Eid is. But it was so disappointing because they were not interested at all. And I even brought candy for them. They just wanted to get on with the content of the class. And I was like, oh man, come on. But yeah, so I mean, that to me sounds so wonderful, to have the welcome of strangers. And you know, yeah. I really appreciate you sharing all your memories, and that's, you know, these are beautiful, beautiful memories. I hope that this Eid is also beautiful with you and your spouse. Eid Mubarak in advance.
Thank you so much. Eid Mubarak to you, Eid Kareem to you too, and to your family. And I hope, you know, your kids have the opportunity to take pictures in their Eid clothes and get lots of Eid.
Don't talk about the Eid part, but yes, the pictures in the clothes will happen.
Don't deprive those kids.
Oh man, they don't know what they're missing.
that's possible.
No. Actually, I do give gifts, because I, you know, they see the Christmas experience. So for the past like 7-8 years, I started giving something small, but having like setting up a gift bag for them near the fireplace, just so that they have that sort of Christmas experience that all their friends are having. And so they have like 30 days of anticipation for a gift bag that's sitting for them at the fire mantle.
Oh, that's lovely. That's something to look forward to. That's great.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Zainab. Inshallah, I look forward to having you on the podcast for a full episode in the future.
Definitely. Cannot wait.
Awesome. Yeah. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam. Take care.